Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Smith, Judge Braffold, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. All right, good morning. Our first case this morning is 823-0960, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life versus the Joint Revocable Trust Agreement of John, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Churras, et al. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument. Please know that the podium goes up and down, so you can adjust it to your level. And whenever you're ready, just approach the podium and then tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. Does go up and down. It costs $300,000, so it had better work.
Good morning, Judge Connolly, and your honors. Nicholas Nelson of Cross Castle PLLC on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. If this is the time I reserve time for rebuttal, I would...
You will automatically get 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. And, may it please the court. So your honors are aware, I do have about 3 minutes of prepared remarks. I welcome the court's questions at any time, but I'll do so explicitly at the end of that. This appeal is basically about contract consideration. Now, when I at least hear that phrase, my mind goes back to first year law school contract class and to learning that consideration for a contract can be anything of any character as long as it's a real detriment to the person promising it. Of course, it's extremely common for there to be contracts where the consideration on one side is a promise to perform services. A contract might say, for instance, I will pay you money and in exchange you will provide me medical care, or care for my children while I'm at work, or whatever the case may be. No one doubts that those are valid contracts with good consideration on both sides. So the question here is, what happens when the promised services are charitable in nature? When an agreement says something like, I will pay you money and in exchange you will, say, build a playground at your local park, or put the money in your college endowment and use it accordingly. Are those promises consideration for a contract? Now, both general contract principles and specific Minnesota case law say that they are. Under general principles, those promises are obviously detriments to the promisor. That person has an obligation to build the playground, to put money in the college endowment that he or she did not have before making the promise. So it's not surprising that the Minnesota Supreme Court has specifically held that charitable undertakings like that can indeed be consideration for a contract. That's the Albert Lee College case we cited in our briefing. Those principles are enough to resolve the central contract issues on this appeal. The defendant trust committed to give MCCL money. MCCL, in exchange, promised in writing to use that money for specific, limited, defined purposes. If MCCL were to breach that promise, to try to use the money for something else, the trust would, and should, have a legal right to enforce MCCL's promises against it. But of course, contract obligations run both ways. Having committed itself in that way, MCCL is also entitled to enforce the trust's exchange promise to pay. And that's what this lawsuit is about.
So, counsel, if I could, one of the phrases you used, and I'm not trying to hold it against you, I just want to inquire about it, is you talked about in a charitable organization where promises made in exchange for a donation that the obligation would be one that the organization did not previously have.
Yes.
Does that sound fairly accurate in terms
I think
of your
it's
argument?
A, yeah, it's one of the basic principles.
You're trying to describe consideration, I think. Right?
Sure, yeah, and a pre-existing obligation is not consideration, right.
So help me understand that in the terms of these precise contracts. So what is the obligation that MCCL did not have that it now has as a result of the contracts that it executed in this case?
Probably two different types of obligations, Your Honor. One was to transfer funds to specific institutions, right? I think the gift was for the transfer
so that's
of money.
Let's call that the first contract. because there are two contracts.
Sure,
right?
Okay. And I mean, there are separate contract principles about whether, you know, instruments signed, you know, that appear to be in conjunction with each other, don't mention each other, you know, are they one contract, are they two contracts? I mean, that's one.
I'm just going based on your complaint, because this is Rule 12, and you indicated you had two contracts, right?
Sure. Fair enough.
So I'm not trying to tie you down to a legal theory, just to go with the Rule 12 context that we have here.
Fair enough. So, okay. So there, I mean, whether you look at them together or separately, you know, one of the commitments that MCCL made was we will pass on, you know, a significant portion of this money to other organizations, right? To the Catholic Church in Reykjavik, to the Mayo Clinic. And from that perspective, you know, I think this is actually not materially distinguishable from, say, a you know, financial contract for the transfer of money, right?
Let's talk about the second contract, if you don't mind.
Certainly.
Yeah, thanks.
Certainly. So, and of course, there's an element of the other contract like that as well, where MCCL says we're going to use this money for specific defined purposes.
But there's no transfer in the second contract, right? No transfer to another organization?
Correct.
Okay. And so what I'm trying to understand, and again, I'm really basing it on your argument, so if I misunderstand your argument, help me out. It seemed to me that you were stating that this contract would be consideration if through it MCCL was undertaking an obligation it did not otherwise have. So what is the obligation that MCCL did not otherwise have until it signed the second contract?
Well, the obligation would be to spend that amount of money doing the activities that it promised to do.
So it's taking the donation, this precise donation, and using it for a purpose that MCCL otherwise would not have done?
Correct. So if MCCL had said, you know, we're accepting this money, but then the next day, you know what, we're going out of business. We can't do it anymore. That would have been a breach of that promise.
All right. And then my next question is, because obviously argument that we hear, well, I think we'll hear from the other side, and it's certainly relevant, indicated by the district court's decision, is that by entering into these contracts and the, in this case, and is it pronounced Mr. Charis?
My understanding is Charest.
Charest, okay,
yeah.
Mr. Charest. So when Mr. Charest entered into the contracts, he transferred at the time of execution a check, right?
Around the same time, yes.
Yeah, around the same time, two checks off of the account for the trust, right?
That's my understanding.
Okay. Now, we all know what happened in the case. I don't want to describe that. But what if Mr. Charest had left and then stopped payment on those checks? Would that have been effective?
It's a good question. I mean, the answer may depend, but I think that if you look at a lot of the, you know, we've pleaded a number of claims that are alternatives or supplements to our contract claim.
Oh, yeah. I only want to talk about the contractual one right now. I appreciate there are other arguments.
All right. So for the contract claim, I would say the answer would be no. I mean, we are not suing based on the checks. We're suing based on these written instruments, right?
Oh, I understand. No, that's not my question. My question is, would you have a claim for breach of contract if Mr. Charest had left, you know, had given, physically transferred to MCCL this check, but then went and stopped payment on the check?
Yes. So
would have had a breach of contract?
Mr. Signed? Charest signed the contracts and then separately wrote the checks, right? So right. The obligation to pay arose from the contracts, and if he had stopped the checks, he would have had an obligation on the contract to pay some other way.
And you rely on the Minnesota case law cited, right?
Correct.
Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I understood
so
your position.
Following up on Judge Bradfield's excellent question, then what do you do with the case? I mean, are you distinguishing sort of breach of ordinary contract and then sort of the Albert Lee Stacks cases that deal with sort of donative contracts? Because a follow-up to one of those cases is the person who was going to give the money to the college changed his mind, stopped payment, and that was fine. So how do you get around that case? And I've forgotten the name of it now.
Yeah.
Is it the Laura Baker School,
yes,
perhaps?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, that case.
So the difference, I think, Your Honor, is that I'm not aware in the Laura Baker case that the college had promised to use the money for any specific purpose. It was simply a gift. You can do what you like with this. That's no different from, you know, I talked to my son about this case in the car this morning. I said, well, if I just promise that I'll give you $100 next week, you can't sue me in order to do that, right? That's Laura Baker.
Oh, he'll just make your life hell.
True. But if I tell him I'll give you $100 next week if you share $80 of it with your sister, that's different. And that's what this case is.
Okay. So And one more follow-up question. Assuming the hypothetical that Judge Bradfold was describing, instead of even giving a check at all, Mr. Schrey left the meeting where he signed the agreement and just never sent a check. He could be sued for breach of contract by MCCL.
Say again, I want to make sure I'm following.
There was no check even ever given. It's not that the check was given and then payment not made by Mr. Schrey.
Correct. The action arises.
Let's just, right. All that happened is he signed the agreement. I'm going to give you this money. You're going to use it for these purposes. And then he left and was like, yeah, I guess not.
Correct.
You could sue for that.
Yes. For purposes of this claim, the method of payment does not matter. What matters is that there was this written instrument. We say it's a contract. He agreed to pay. So he has to pay some way or another, whether it's by check or any other way.
And I'm a bit following up on Judge Connolly's question. So you differentiate this from, say, a check that arrives in the mail to MCCL because there's no particular promise tied to that check that arrives in the mail.
Exactly.
Right?
Correct. That's just a simple gift that the giver is free to change his or her mind about until the funds are transferred.
Mr. Nelson, the second contract, I seem to recall there was, well, you tell me, or was the first contract, but I thought there was also an agreement they were going to set up a special scholarship. Am I misreading that?
I'm not recalling that.
All right, so maybe I'm wrong. So, but you're saying this is different from just, he sent a check and, you know, use it for the general operating funds as opposed to this or that, the other thing.
Correct, yes.
Okay, fine.
With a few minutes remaining, if the court has no further questions, I would just, I guess, remark about the other claims, the supplementary and alternative claims, to say that the issue there is mostly one of Minnesota pleading law.
Which favors you.
Correct, Your Honor. The defendants basically argued, and the district court basically agreed, that with respect to each of these claims, MCCL had missed pleading facts, you know, supporting some detail or some element of the claims. Whether or not that's true, it doesn't warrant dismissal under Minnesota law, because a plaintiff in Minnesota is not required to plead facts supporting each detail, each element of the claim. You know, the black letter obligation is plead facts consistent with each detail, each element of the claim. We would say we've done that. I think a good illustration is the promissory estoppel claim. And the similar things are true of the others, but I'll illustrate with the promissory estoppel claim. You know,
the alternative to your contract claim.
That one is indeed. If there's a contract, there's no need for promissory estoppel. But what the complaint pleads is February 10th, these written instruments are signed. MCCL is told in writing, you will get this money, is handed the checks. Then more than 2 weeks later, MCCL tries to deposit the checks, can't do it, and sometime after that, we don't know exactly when, MCCL is told by the trust, yeah, never mind, we're not going to honor them. So it's at least there's at least a 15-day gap, and MCCL pleads in that 15-day gap, we relied. And the defendants object, well, you didn't say how you relied. You didn't plead the facts of how you relied. And the district court dismissed on that basis, and that we would say is not correct under Minnesota law. The facts are wholly consistent with reliance happening in that time, and those details get filled in discovery at the summary judgment stage, wherever that would be.
And how do you differentiate the portion of the complaint that you're referring to, the Second Amended complaint, this pleading of reliance, from a legal conclusion? Because we do have case law saying that it is not sufficient to state a legal conclusion in a complaint and survive Rule 12.
I would suggest, and this is, you know, getting into the nitty-gritty of Minnesota pleading law, but I would suggest that there's a difference between simply pleading a conclusion that's in tension with or not consistent with the rest of the complaint versus pleading a conclusion that fits very comfortably into the other facts pleaded by the complaint.
Oh, okay. So what are the other facts that fits comfortably into reliance?
The facts being the time frame that I just described, that there's this 15-day, at least 15-day gap that is expressly pleaded in the complaint, where MCCL has the checks, is planning on getting the money, and then finally at the end of that time learns, oh, the trust is not going to honor this. I would say that ordinary
time alone is enough to demonstrate reliance.
No, not at trial, right? I mean, we can't show up at trial and
as an allegation, right? Because we accept that you can prove.
This is the consistency that I'm talking about. I mean, in ordinary life, you would expect that if a person had an $800,000 check for 15 days, they might do something in response to that, right? So that's the consistency that I'm talking about.
All right. So I do have a question about your civil theft claim. So in the civil theft theft claim, I'm not exactly sure I'm clear. You know, it obviously involves a statutory claim, involves stealing the personal property of another. What is the property that you are alleging was stolen by the defendants?
The property is the funds themselves. So it is.
Well, that's where I'm a little struggling. The funds themselves. Okay, so the defendants moved funds that belonged to the trust, right? The funds belonged to the trust when they were moved.
Correct.
Correct. Your claim, your property, if I'm following your complaint, is, you know, the check, perhaps? I don't know. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but, you know, what is the property that MCCL had that was stolen?
So what I would analogize this to, and I believe this is the intent of the complaint, is that this is the equivalent of an intercept of a funds transfer, right? So, and the key here to understand is that MCCL's central claim is that the actions of the successor trustee, Nicholas Charest, do not represent the genuine, legitimate actions of the trust in the same way that the actions of the previous trustee did, John Charest, because MCCL's claim is Nicholas Charest improperly allowed his interests as beneficiary to override, to control over his duties as trustee. So the allegation that's central to the civil theft claim and some others is that essentially this is a one party attempting to transfer funds to another and a third party stepping in to intercept those funds. And that's where we say the civil theft comes in and other things. I see my time is up. I will look forward to rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
One second, Your Honor. Mr. Nelson is a tad bit taller than I am. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Windler. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Winthrop and Weinstein, and I represent respondents, the joint revocable trust agreement of John N. Charest and Svenda Charest, and Nicholas Charest as trustee. Because the district court did not err in dismissing all counts of MCCL's second amended complaint, we respectfully request that the Court of Appeals affirm the district court's order. This is a straightforward case of a contemplated donation in which the donor changed its mind and canceled the donation before completion, and importantly, before MCCL took any action in reliance on the alleged donation. And despite the tragic factual circumstances, in essence, it's a case, that's all the case is about. The court seems to be aware of the facts. There are a couple very important points, though. Number one, the gifts, the alleged gifts, and the checks were written from the trust. So as between John Charest as trustee and Nick Charest as trustee, it is irrelevant. The trustee is acting on behalf of the trust. So when the checks were canceled.
So you're saying your client stepped in the shoes of the original gentleman who died, and therefore he gets to cancel the check just as in the Laura Baker case. What if, under the breach of fiduciary duty, do you agree that a trustee has the obligation to pay creditors of the trust?
Legitimate creditors, that is correct.
Okay. And he didn't, at the time he moved all the money to the other account, he didn't say, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm going to get a declaration from the court, we're going to figure out whether this is a gift or is a contract or is a legitimate creditor. Your client didn't do that, right?
Not at the time he moved the money. However, there is an action pending in Hennepin County right now in which MCCL could make a claim as a legitimate creditor, and that could be litigated.
Well, what I'm asking is, did your client start a lawsuit, start a DIC action saying, hey, here's all this money, I'm not sure where, you know, I don't think the MCCL should get it, but by the same token, I don't want to breach any duties, so I'm going to deposit it with the court, and then we'll have these arguments. He didn't do that. He just transferred all the money to a new account, right?
Correct.
And was he the sole beneficiary of the account?
He is the sole beneficiary of the trust.
So there, of the trust, excuse me, I apologize. That's where, under Rule 12, I have some concerns as to whether there is a claim for a breach of fiduciary duty, since if it was a legitimate claim, and I understand, you know, you don't agree, you know, he's not honoring it, and he's honoring it for his own benefit.
So
there, I think that could be problematic. Now, why am I wrong, counsel?
Two reasons, Your Honor.
For under Rule 12?
Two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it's basic trust law that a trustee owes a fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries of the trust.
No, I got that.
So number one, I think everyone is in violation.
But can a trustee pay himself before legitimate creditors?
That has not happened because he started a proceeding in Hennepin County in which it's going through probate. It's going through an ordinary course. And creditors were allowed to file claims. MCCL has filed a claim.
Okay.
I would also say you are only a creditor if you have a cause of action independent of a breach of fiduciary duty claim against
the
trust.
Like a breach of contract?
Like a breach of contract. So if the breach of contract claim dies, they are not a creditor, there is no fiduciary duty owed. That's the ending analysis. And that would show that...
And how do we decide that on Rule 12? I mean, that seems to have just a host of fact questions that you may ultimately prevail on, even on summary judgment.
Yep.
But it seems to me that the opinion is a little sparse in terms of the reasoning to get through all those hurdles on those six different causes of action. And here, like Judge Bradfield, I'm focusing on the breach of contract and the fiduciary duty breach.
I would respectfully submit that if the court agrees that there is not a properly pled breach of contract claim and it affirms the breach of contract dismissal, they can't be a legitimate creditor because they are not a creditor. So therefore, there is no duty owed. So I think they went hand in hand.
That's also a circular argument.
I don't think it is because how is a duty owed to you if you're not a creditor? And if the court decides you're not a creditor, there's no duty owed. I don't think that's circular. It's just you're deciding both doors at the same time.
So I might have forgotten this, but if we decided that their breach of contract claim survived Rule 12, if we were to reverse on that, I thought you still had an argument that this is the wrong place to bring the...
That's correct.
Okay, so it's not a... They're not the converse or obverse or whatever, inverse, whatever the right word is of each other. So even if we were to reverse on that, there's the breach of fiduciary duty fails, and that is because why?
If they are a creditor, the breach of fiduciary duty fails, the allegations are that the breach of fiduciary duty claim is supported by the canceling of the checks, which can't be a breach of fiduciary duty because the trustee did what the trustee is empowered to do. He collected assets of the trust. And then they are free to file a claim within Hennepin County against the trust.
But why do they have to do it that way as opposed to, if the breach of contract claim we decide could go forward, why couldn't they bring the breach of fiduciary duty in this case, claim in this case?
I'm not sure that they can't.
Okay.
I think the more proper venue is in Hennepin County.
Right. Okay.
But to be clear, if they don't have a claim, if the court determines they are not a creditor, no duty is owed. There's only two paths to having a duty here. And in trust law, I would represent that I think the case law is and the trust code is that a fiduciary duty is only owed to the beneficiaries. It doesn't say beneficiaries and creditors. It says beneficiaries. They are not a beneficiary, period. I think that probably answers Your Honor's question.
Okay, so it doesn't exist under trust law.
It doesn't exist under trust law. It's not pled under trust law. Mm-hmm. They allege they're a beneficiary. Their complaint doesn't say we're a creditor. It says we're a third-party beneficiary, which has never been recognized in trust law in the state of Minnesota, which is why the appellant is citing third-party treatises. It's not recognized anywhere in Minnesota law. So no duty is owed because they are not a beneficiary. And then if they are a creditor, they have to go through the path of Hennepin County. I will address the breach of contract claim, because that is where the appellant spent most of their time. And I think we're all in agreement that consideration is required. It just might be a different standard when you're dealing with a charitable organization. And what the Albert Lee College and In re Stacks cases hold, and those are the only two cases cited by appellant, are that if a contemplated donation is stated, and prior to payment, the device or the donor dies or it is not made, it can be enforced against the estate, provided that the donee does something in reliance. The consideration can be completed by the donee's side. That's what those cases stand for. And Albert Lee College, the college was in financial distress, and you had someone promise to pay $2,500, and the college stayed in, stayed running and took on debt in reliance on that. So they said you can bring a claim under that. In the In re Stacks case.
So Albert Lee, you're saying they took on debt?
Yes, and that's recognized both in the decision and also in the Ross case cited in our decision, which I know is an unpublished.
Setting aside Ross for a moment. So sure. In Albert Lee, the Minnesota Supreme Court relied on the debt.
I believe that, yes.
Okay, and in the other case, Stacks?
In In re Stacks, they went out and held out that they had this like first donation and solicited other donations from third parties, and they started to construct buildings. They added on to buildings. So they did something assuming they have the money.
Now, those two cases were not Rule 12 cases, right?
They were not Rule 12 cases.
So what do we do with the argument that appellant's counsel made, which is that this is a case where, you know, if you look at the scope of the pleadings and the factual allegations, we have a time lag, right? And we have a specific plan expressed in the two contracts that are attached to the complaint, which suggests, you know, in one of them that MCCL is going to be making donations to Mayo, to a church in Iceland, as well as spending the money on programming, and then the second, spending money on particular programming. So in that time lag, can't they, under Rule 12, wouldn't we assume that they could offer evidence to show that they took steps during that time?
I don't know.
Because they do plead reliance, right? I mean, you see that allegation. They plead reliance.
They say a magic word, and they say that they relied.
Counsel, magic words. Don't we live and breathe by magic words in a court of law, right?
Correct, but they also stated a legal conclusion in order to try and meet a legal standard on their second amended complaint, which was their third bite at the apple. And they are required to plead how they relied. It's black letter Minnesota law. You cannot just say the elements of a cause of action and then say, look, we meet Rule 12. It would turn Rule 12 on its head. And
the Minnesota Supreme Court has been quite definite recently that even conclusory allegations may be sufficient under Rule 12, because if a court of law gets in the middle and says, that's just conclusory, it's really shortcutting the both the concept of Rule 12 as well as circumventing a plaintiff from pursuing their claim and offering the proof that would be shown. So can you respond to that?
I think what appellate is saying that we wait, there's 15 days, and I'm unaware of any case law that says that waiting 15 days or having a 15-day time gap constitutes reliance.
That's not my question, though. You realize that. It's not about whether they pled 15 days. It's whether they can offer proof. You know, under Rule 12, would this court assume that MCCL could offer proof that they took steps in reliance during that period of time, given the concrete nature of these particular promises?
I believe the law is still that you have to plead the elements of the causes of action and not the bare bones allegations.
In what case do you think, out of our Minnesota Supreme Court, is the best statement of that?
I don't have that in front of me, Your Honor. I apologize. I would say that there is no allegation in the complaint. There is no allegation in any of the three complaints. There's no allegation in any of the briefing papers. There's no allegations in any of the affidavits that were submitted. There's no allegations or references to, in this court's record, that any actual reliance was made. There's no allegation that the checks were submitted. I will submit to the court that if MCCL stood up and said, we sent a $100,000 check to Iceland, and it was cashed and it cleared, or we sent a check to Mayo and it cashed and it was cleared, or we promised them and now they've sued us and that's a problem, That would be a completely different case. Those allegations are not in this record.
I was wondering, and, you know, this is probably not at the Rule 12 stage, but it's just, I'm trying to figure out the difference between this charitable subscription and what the case law is around that and breach of contract.
Yep.
And it seems to be, you know, like, and you talked about sort of being maybe a lower level of consideration. It's just interesting that those cases, to me, required specific performance. Because when I think of this as a damages case on a breach of contract, I'm like, what damages are even alleged here? They haven't spent money, as I could see in the complaint yet, apropos of what you just said. So I'm trying to figure out how this all fits together. You get a lower standard, but you get specific performance in a charitable concept.
And I wouldn't say it's a lower standard. I would say it's a different standard.
Okay.
It puts it on what the plaintiff does. I would also note, Your Honor, two things. Number one, I would respectfully submit that my colleague's example with his son is not correct. We're talking about a standard that only applies to religious, educational, and nonprofit institutions. Telling your son, I'll pay you $100 next week for nothing if you give your sister $80, there's no consideration as to the grantor. That's not a contract. That's basic contract law. That loses. So we're talking about a very narrow example in Minnesota case law. Now, I think an interesting question would be if Mr. John Charay, when MCCL showed up to Mr. Charay's house with the two letters in hand and had him sign, is as MCCL is getting into the car, Mr. Charay yells from his front door and says, I changed my mind. In that situation, I think we should all agree MCCL's done nothing. They've told no one. They've relied on nothing. They've sent no checks. They've not done anything. Could they survive a complaint by saying we relied? And I think the answer is no. That is what In Re Stax and Albert Lee says, that there has to be some for these institutions that rely on donations, they must do something other than accept a promise to pay. They must be out something. And I would just like to note, I know I'm out of time, that the promissory estoppel claim that counsel mentioned fails for the exact same reason. There's no reliance. That is a distinct element of promissory estoppel. There has to be reliance to the detriment of the appellant here. And there's case law that you can't just plead the magic words. With that, Your Honor, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nelson, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. First, of course, you know, there can be cases where a gift is given gratuitously and the giver can change his or her mind. This is not one. When someone wants to make a binding transfer of funds, the way you would expect them to do it would be to create a written instrument that recites exchange promises and has people's signatures on it. That's exactly what Mr. Charay did here, and we want to allow people to enter into binding contracts like that. This is what the law of contracts sets out to allow people to make promises like this. I would add on that front that we want contracts like this to be enforceable, not just for the interest of the recipient of the funds, but for the interest of the giver of the funds as well. People make contributions like this all the time, and they want to have the ability to legally dictate what they will be used for. The easiest way to do that is a contract, which again has to run both ways. So if there's no consideration for this deal, then assuming the fund handed over the money, MCCL would have been free to send all its employees to Hawaii or to, you know, decide to open a new line of business. And the trust would not be able to complain about it because, according to them, there would have been no consideration for the contract and it would not have been enforceable. Perhaps the court would have to make up some new sort of doctrine, legal doctrine, in order to make that enforceable.
It just seems like a lot. You know, I mean, there are a lot of donations to educational institutions that say, I want this to be used for undergraduate scholarships. But then they have a change in fortune. You know, and they even sign an MOU. I'm going to, you know, this will go toward undergraduate education, and I'm going to, you know, give this money. But then they change their mind because they've lost their job, and it's like, you know what, I can't continue to give these money. It's like, you know, in all of those situations, you're saying that actually the donor can be sued by the institution, that they have to continue giving money prospectively.
I think it would depend on the terms of the promise, right? I mean, you know,
I'm going to give you money, and you'll use it for undergraduate donations. I mean, scholarships.
So if there's a specific sum of money, then yes, I would agree. You know, I think if it's, you know, I'm going to give you X dollars per month, I don't think that the courts would necessarily read that to be an obligation in perpetuity, right? I think that there would have to be some, you know, for how long, right? If that term were left open, then that would become a question of the parties' intent. I would like to touch briefly on the points that opposing counsel made about the fiduciary duty and civil theft claims. I think we would agree that those claims are supplementary to the other claims that the trust had a legal obligation to pay. So they would be supplementary not just to the contract claim, but to the promissory estoppel claim, to the unjust enrichment claim, others. If there is a legal duty to pay grounded in those claims, then the fiduciary duty, the civil theft claims would arise. I believe the parties actually agree about that.
What agree about? Why would that be? I thought that the argument is there's no third party beneficiary.
Well, perhaps that's a separate argument.
Law to bring
I thought I heard my colleague say that if there is a separate obligation to pay, then duties might arise, you know, under the provisions of the trust that require payment to creditors and that sort of
right,
thing.
Right, you could seek payment as a creditor in the proper.
Correct, and that you know, legitimate creditor relationship is what the fiduciary duty, the civil theft claims depend upon.
I did not hear opposing counsel say that, so help me understand if that's your argument. You're claiming that your civil theft argument is based on your relationship, your status as a creditor? I mean, I appreciate it's in the alternative to your other.
Sure. So I think it goes back, Judge Bradfield, to what you asked about before, who's were these funds, right? So we're not saying that the civil theft statute just by itself gave MCCL a legal entitlement to this money, right? The legal entitlement came from the contract, came from promissory estoppel, came from something else. Once you have that legal entitlement in place, That's the predicate then for a civil theft claim, if that makes sense.
Mr. Nielsen, I assume the contracts are in the record.
They are. They are the exhibits to the complaint.
And if we find as a matter of law that looking at those contracts that there isn't valid consideration, because based on what you're saying, you know, $100,000 to Reykjavik, $100,000 to Mayo, then the breach of contract claim fails, right?
Even
under Rule 12.
Correct. That would be, I mean.
And if that fails, the breach of fiduciary obligation or fiduciary duty claim fails because you're not a creditor.
Well, I would say then you would look at the promissory estoppel, the unjust enrichment claims, right? You would have to go through those too. And we would say that, you know, those claims typically arise when the parties tried to make a contract, but there was some sort of technical defect, right? So we think this would be a classic situation where those claims would then, you know, be the operative ones.
But there's nothing in the record, you know, there's nothing in the record that indicates, okay, you know, Mayo started hiring doctors for the $100,000, or that the church in Reykjavik started breaking ground, or that I think the other one is to support pro-life activities, that MCCL hired, you know, five people and, you know, they're on the payroll. There's nothing that in the record, right?
With respect to MCCL, I mean, that's right. But with respect to MCCL, that's the issue I was discussing with Judge Bradfield, that we'd like the chance to prove that. And to be clear, I mean, we do want the chance to prove reliance. We think if we need to, that we would be able to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. Thank you. Did I pronounce your name right, Ms. Windler? Thank you. Well, at least I got two out of three. So the matter is submitted. We will be issuing our opinion within 90 days.